4th of July, come see 30 Seconds Over Tokyo on the big screen at the Loft Theater, 3233 East Speedway, featuring Van Johnson and Spencer Tracy as Jimmy Doolittle and their daring raid in the early part of World War II.
I want you to get 24 B-25s with volunteer crews down to Eglin Field. Tell them it's a secret mission.
Doors open at 11, movie at noon. That's this 4th of July at the Loft Theater on Speedway. Doors open at 11.
Now, I realize it's fashionable in some circles to believe that no one in government should encourage others to read the Bible. That we're told that we'll violate the constitutional separation of church and state established by the Founding Fathers in the First Amendment. The First Amendment was not written to protect people and their laws from religious values. It was written to protect those values from government tyranny.
Welcome to Liberty Watch, an independent program on KVOI, Tucson's Voice of Freedom. This program is dedicated to the principle of eternal vigilance, which is necessary to maintain a free society. It promotes the free flow of information about government, technology, education, current events, and history, relying upon our steadfast Constitution to frame the informed consent of the Republic so that government forever remains servant, not master. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of KVOI, its sponsors, or guests. Liberty Watch is produced and hosted by Charles Heller. Any mistakes are his responsibility.
My favorite 15 seconds of the week are the time between the end of that open and the close of the music. My part, my turn. I don't know about you guys, but I look forward to this part all week long. I hope you do too. Christopher Liebig is a novelist, and he's also a criminal defense attorney who lives and works in Alexandria, Virginia. His first two published books, Saving Saddam, a 2008 novel about the trial of Saddam Hussein, and Montanamo, a 2010 novel about Guantanamo Bay detainees being housed in a small Montana town's prison, were published by Artnik Books in London, of all places. Saving Saddam was re-released in 2014 under its original American title, The Black Rabbit, and it is a joy and pleasure to welcome to the microphones and telephones of Liberty Watch for the first time, Christopher Liebig. Welcome, sir.
Charles, thanks a lot for having me.
My pleasure. I'm glad you, as I like to tell people, I'm glad you could be had. So what malady an acrid bit you to want to become a criminal defense attorney?
Well, you know, I went to law school like a lot of people.
Nothing like a loaded question.
Yeah, totally. I went to law school not knowing why, like most people, and then I did a clerkship at a public defender's office in Washington, D.C., and I loved it. I loved the investigation. I loved, you know, trying to figure out the cases, and I liked the clients, and that I just got really, like, professionally electrified by that. So I wanted to be a public defender, which I did for 6 years, and then I started my own firm doing criminal defense with a group of other former public defenders, and it's just the right fit for me. You know, I like protecting people's rights. I like connecting with the clients, and I think it's important work because that's where the contours of our rights get defined, actually, is in criminal cases.
You can elaborate on that.
So, you know, I think one thing about people sometimes have a negative connotation with criminal defense attorneys unless they get in trouble. But what I think people don't think about a lot is that our rights, such as against search and seizure, you know, unreasonable searches by the government, the right to remain silent, general freedoms, those are fought for in criminal courts because you have to be charged with something to raise one of those issues.
Right, because otherwise you don't have standing otherwise.
Right. I mean, you could sue the government for invading your home, but no one does it because what are the damages going
to
be?
Nothing. Right. You have to have an articulable damage in order to gain standing.
And so the fight over those rights goes on in the small cases across the U.S. with criminal defense attorneys arguing for broader protections and prosecutors arguing for less.
I want to lovingly... I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish your statement.
Oh, I was going to say, I think a lot of people don't realize that that is where that battle is fought. It really is a libertarian endeavor to go to court and advocate on behalf of a client, no matter what they've done, to protect their rights.
Well, I agree with you. It's a libertarian endeavor, but it's also, to some extent, a drumhead or star chamber trial in most cases, because the presumption of regularity is with the state, as opposed to, even though the presumption of innocence is supposed to be with the individual. You and I both know that we've had an absolute inversion of that principle, and now the principle of regularity is, for the most part, with the state as opposed to with the individual. And so, what I would like to expand what you say, not disagree with it, but lovingly expand on it, which is, I think part of the fight is in the courtroom, but part of the fight is actually at the state legislative level, when organizations go to the state and lobby the state to change laws that add to the presumption of reasonableness. And I say that from a basis of experience, having been a co-founder of the Arizona Citizens Defense League. We have had 42 good bills signed by three governors over 10 and a half, now almost 11 years. And we have changed. They ended affirmative defenses in Arizona in 1996. And we got that change. We got the presumption of reasonableness added back to Arizona law, particularly because of the Hal Fish case. And I got to tell you that, hey, the wind is really kicking up there. If there's any place you can go for shelter, that would be great. But anyway, we got the presumption of regularity added back in, or the presumption of reasonableness added back to self-defense in Arizona. And if you're in a place you can write it down, I'll give you the law, the citation, because it's something you guys might want to try in Virginia, although your Virginia Citizens Defense League is very, very active at getting laws like that passed. But it's Arizona Revised Statutes Title 13, Part 419. It's ARS 13-419, and it's the presumption of reasonableness. And that if you use force or deadly force in any to combat any of certain enumerated crimes, I don't have time to list them all, but if you use force, physical force or deadly physical force, and the reason you did it was to stop those enumerated crimes, you are presumed by law to have acted reasonably under the circumstances, unless, of course, the evidence clearly countermands your claim. So those are other ways where the fight goes on, as well as in court. Your response?
Most definitely. I want to check that out. That is very interesting, and quite frankly, I've never thought of that. It reminds me a little bit of a stand your ground law.
It is. It's part of it.
More sophisticated.
Right. Well, what's called stand your ground in quotes is actually not stand your ground. It's actually no requirement to retreat. And it's a very significant difference, because people see stand your ground as this to stand with, as the Declaration of Independence says, with manly firmness and defend yourself. And that's not what it is. It's so that some avaricious prosecutor doesn't go after you for failing to back up when tactically it was a stupid move.
And I agree with you. And right around the time of the Trayvon Martin case, we defended a police officer accused of murder of a citizen. And so the issue did come up. And the fact is, the law already, at least in Virginia, does not require someone to retreat if they were not the aggressor. They have to use only reasonable force. But that is kind of, the stand your ground law is kind of built within that. Yeah, I agree with the national attention to that notion was blown out of proportion. But the law you're talking about sounds sophisticated in that it lists enumerated crimes and it go ahead.
It was legislation that we wrote a model for and was largely adopted by the legislative council. Lobbyists don't write laws. Lobbyists make suggestions and present models from other states and such. But we presented a model to the joint legislative council of the legislature. Actually, we presented it to a couple legislators who then turned around and presented it to their legislative council, and their legislative council drafted legislation based on our model, and it was even voted on by some of our normal opponents in the fight for the right to keep and bear arms, because it had to do with the presumption of innocence. And several of the people who are normally against us are also defense attorneys. So even though they're morally opposed to our existence in most cases, they actually voted with us.
Yeah, and you know what we're involved with? It's kind of like that, and I don't know where you guys are in Arizona on this issue, but it's marijuana.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, nothing. My colleagues and I are members of NORML, an organization devoted to legalization or decriminalization of marijuana. And, you know, in the last 7 or 8 years, they're winning.
Yeah, NORML is the National Association for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
Yes.
Right.
Go ahead.
I'll tell you, if you want to solve a lot of violence problems in this country, legalize it and take all the drug warriors and put them on people who have known criminal actors. And you will greatly ratchet down the violence in this country, and you will take away some of the reasons for violence, which is the huge market created by the government by making marijuana illegal.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And it takes a while for people to get an understanding of this, but the Mexican cartel problem is because of criminalization in the United States in large part.
We're enablers.
Yeah, completely. And another fact, and some people I really believe just don't like to hear this, including judges and lots of law enforcement people, but it's been conclusively proven that you cannot stop drugs from coming into the United States.
No, it's impossible.
You can't.
There's another thing and that's that we're up on a break. But I'm going to talk about prohibition vis-a-vis firearms when we come back break on AM 1030 KVOI Cortero Tucson, the voice in the Perfection Auto Works studios. Call in now if you have a question with a working criminal defense attorney who's got his head screwed on right. He's one of the 5% that doesn't give the 95% a bad name.
This is Herman Cain, and you're listening to Liberty Watch, so that government remains a servant, not master.
Stood before the judge that day as he refused me bail. Knew that I would spend my time awaiting trial in jail. I said, there is no justice as they let me out. Judge said, this isn't a court of justice, son. This is a court of law.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch, where we're talking about the difference between law and justice with Christopher Liebig. His newest book is Almost Mortal. It's an interesting story about a lawyer who has some issues of clairvoyancy and how he applies them to the wheels of justice. And compared to in speaking, are you with us, Christopher?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Speaking of the wheels of justice, compared to its designed intent, how well does our criminal prosecution system and defense system work?
You know, here's going back to the root of that, I always like to think of it this way. The common law British sort of themes that were put into the U.S. Constitution, such as the right to a jury trial, the right to a trial in your own jurisdiction, you know, search and seizure, all of that, that had a common law British tradition. The tradition was that local people would mistrust the government and not want the government to be able to incarcerate and punish their fellow citizens unless they had strong evidence and were able to prove it. The problem now, at least in Northern Virginia and other places in the U.S. that are like that, is that the citizens generally love the government. So when a defendant gets brought into a courtroom, they're looking at a jury of people that are looking with admiration at the prosecution and suspicion at the citizen. And that is not the way that was intended to be.
No, it's an inversion. So it's an inversion of the presumption of innocence. Right.
And what the envisionment of the framers of the Constitution would be, they're looking with suspicion at the prosecutor. That's the king saying, oh no, you're not locking up one of us unless you prove it. And today I just think that's completely inverted. The jurors think their job a lot of times is just to listen to the evidence and make sure, you know, unless there's something really blatantly wrong, to find the person guilty. And that's in part why the conviction rate in a jury trial in the U.S. is over 85%, and we all know they get it wrong.
Right.
Sometimes.
I tell people, don't try to escape jury service, but for goodness sakes, don't, whatever you do, don't tell them that you know that the job of the juror is to judge the law as well as to judge the facts. Because a juror is known as the trier of the fact. But the judge, the last thing in the world the judge wants the jury to understand is that he's also a trier of both the law and the prosecution. And that, and I'll tell you categorically, one of the things I do when I teach the concealed weapons class, I'm certified by the state to teach the laws on the use of deadly force. And one of the things I tell people to do is take their notes in the class and their copy of the laws that apply to self-defense and date them and write the address and sign them and then mail them to themselves certified. Take a copy first, mail them to themselves and leave the envelope sealed. And now, if it, God forbid, you should be charged with anything, your defense attorney opens the seal on the envelope in court and presents into evidence as to your state of mind your training in the Arizona concealed weapons class, and it contains, the first thing in there is a copy of the laws on the use of force and self-defense, at which point the judge wishes he was wearing his Depends to work. Because the last thing in the because the last thing in the world he wants in that courtroom is a copy of the law. Because the judge is going to say to the jurors, "I'll tell you the law. I'll give you the law. That, you are the triers of the fact."
Charles, that idea is smart on so many levels.
Well, it's not original with. Go ahead.
I love it, and here's what that makes me think, and I'll try to explain this quickly. But it's a big policy thing that almost no one knows. Back in the 1890s, there was a United States Supreme Court case called Sparf versus United States.
Oh, that's where you pull the name of that prosecutor. Oh, baby, that's exactly good. That is a good loop. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So we call this a Sparf motion, and we file it in cases, and I've done it in a couple gun cases. But what it says is the Sparf v. U.S. basically said you can't have jury nullification. Jury nullification means when the jury thinks the evidence is sufficient but doesn't want to convict because they don't believe in the law. That was what Thomas Jefferson wanted the function of a jury to be. He thought the jurors would say, no, they could acquit for any reason, including we don't follow this law. And so we've argued this in court, and once you take that all the way through the pike of where that would go if that were ever reversed, you realize what a big deal it is. For example, if they allowed open arguing of jury nullification, that is, defense attorney saying to the jury, send a message to the legislature that you don't like this law and find this guy not guilty even though he did it. If you could make that argument, imagine how few people would get convicted of tax evasion.
Well, here's the thing. You can't do, in view of Sparf, you can't actually do that. But what you could do is you could change it at the state level. You could have your state level citizens defense leagues, like your West Virginia Citizens Defense League and your Virginia Citizens Defense League organizations, go to their respective legislatures and they could propose fully informed jury language. It can't be called a fully informed jury. It'll never pass, but it could be added to other criminal procedure rules and other criminal procedure statutes where the judge is required to tell the jury that if they believe that the prosecution has not has misconstrued the evidence, that they may find the person guilty even though the evidence has been presented in the way that it has, that they can acquit. And that the judge is required to tell them that, because now it's a matter of procedural law, not a matter of nullification. Because if you as a juror go in, like, say, on a marijuana case and say, I find the guy not guilty, and they say, well, why? The evidence is overwhelming. Well, I don't believe in marijuana laws. The next thing you're going to hear is a jury dismissal, and they're going to bring in an alternate. But as a juror, if you say to the judge when he says, why did you find this guy not guilty? If you say to that judge, well, in my heart of hearts, I don't believe that the prosecutor met his burden of proof. There is zero that judge can do any except uphold your verdict. And it only takes one juror to do that. It'll hang the jury.
And people don't understand that, and it's tough when you're sticking up against the whole group. You know, juries a lot of times are about group dynamics.
Right.
And but I'll tell you an interesting one, if you don't mind, real quick, on that Sparf issue.
Go right ahead.
We had a case of a woman charged with possession of firearm by convicted felon. And so because of the Heller case, and it came out of D.C., the rights of gun rights actually were expanded by the U.S. Supreme Court by because they invalidated the per se gun ban in the District of Columbia. And from that, a lot of arguments can flow, one of which is it should be unconstitutional to ban a convicted felon from having a gun if the felony has no connection to violence.
Right.
Because it's illogical. It doesn't pass the rational basis test. So our client was a woman who had a felony of sex abuse of a minor to a teenager that she later married. And our motion was, we need to be able to tell the jury what about that felony, and that it's unfair that she shouldn't be able to have a gun. She lives out in the country. There's a million reasons.
Let me guess, the judge wouldn't allow the argument.
He was perplexed by it, and he took it under advisement, because I think he'd never heard of that before, and he ended up denying it, which
of course
was a given.
Right.
And I'd love to take that one on appeal. It ended up resolving itself, but because there's a lot on the move with the gun laws in that respect.
Yeah, there is. You know, and I'm part of it on both the local and the national scene. But I got to tell you, and by the way, Heller is not related to me, although I wish he was. I've interviewed him. But, you know, Dick, I know Dick Heller. He's been an interview subject of mine, but I'm no Dick Heller. So anyway, but I digress. We've got a caller who's been very, very patient. I want to go ahead and get him on. He's also another host on this station with another program later today. So, Sean, you're live on Liberty Watch with Attorney Christopher Liebig. Your question or comment for Mr. Liebig.
Counselor, it sounds like Blackstone has been relegated to the scrap heap of history.
A lot of it has. I mean, the United States government has become so large that following the common law principles that the founders actually believed has become close to impossible. I mean, we have to collect so much revenue. The regulations are completely out of control, and I think that's a function of the size that government has become. I mean, keeping in mind that the time of the Constitution, we didn't really even envision having a standing national army of this size unless there was a crisis. We weren't an interventionist nation. Everything's just completely changed.
We used to actually play by the non-aggression principle, but I gotta ask you, I mean, government has control, complete and utter control of two things in the world I live in, schools and prisons. They can't keep drugs and crime out of prison, and although I think that prison, it's the cage they threaten you with and the rape they threaten you with if you violate their laws, why would we think that government can eliminate crime in the entirety of society if the places that they completely control, they can't eliminate crime there?
A great point, and makes me think about drug interdiction, but other things too. Everybody knows there's drugs in prison. Everybody knows there's contraband, cell phones, you name it. And that's because of corruption, but you can't stop that. I mean, maybe if you wanted to quadruple the salary of everybody that works in the prison system, but that's not happening. But it's like acting like we can stop anything, including people from coming over the border.
Weather. We're almost acting like we can stop weather.
Well, wait a minute. All we need is
because
a law, isn't it? All we need is a law, isn't it?
That's what I want, Charles. I want one more law from the law and order crowd.
That's what
me say. Like, you know, and there used to be a principle at play that it causes disrespect to the government to have unenforceable laws. And, you know, I'll name an immigration example. You guys might not agree with this one, but if you ever try to call ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, call them and get a live person on the phone in Washington, D.C., it's extremely hard to do. The reason for that is they don't want anybody answering those calls because of the hundreds of thousands of calls they'd get saying, hey, I know this guy I think might be an illegal immigrant.
Well, I got to tell you,
the fact is that they aren't trying to, there is no mechanism, they're not going to send it.
The mechanism. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was listening to a radio station today where they were interviewing an illegal immigrant about the death of his brother at that club in Orlando.
Yeah.
They gave the guy's name and where he lived. It's like, hello.
Nobody's going to do it. Yeah,
if you're an ICE agent, you take out your little spiral notebook, you write that down, you know, kind of tap your middle finger to your tongue, wet the page, you know, wet your finger a little bit, flip to a blank page, write it down, and go get the guy.
And it's never, that's not, that level of enforcement is simply not done. What happens is somebody gets arrested and prosecuted for a crime, then it does kick in.
Right.
But generally, there's nobody attempting to do that. So you have a law which is not enforced, which makes people just generally disrespected. And,
well,
you know,
I'll give you an example of that writ large. All right. That's a microcosm. Let me give you a macro view of it. We don't expect, at least as citizens, we have come not to expect to get either candor or necessarily the truth from the political class. We have come to expect that our political leadership will lie to us. As a result, the value of telling the truth has greatly been diminished, so much so that we don't even worry about prosecuting people who don't tell the truth to agents of our government. And that's why, for instance, the former president of the United States lost his law license because he committed perjury before a grand jury. All right, stand by.
This is Herman Cain, and you're listening to Liberty Watch, so that government remains servant, not master. Sundays right after Swap Shop.
Thank you for stressing Article 2, Section 2 of the Arizona Constitution. Political power comes from the people, and government gets its power from the consent of the governed. Purpose is to protect individual rights. Thank you for asking people running for elective office to know what this means.
Liberty Watch, so that government remains servant, not master. Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., right after Swap Shop.
Y'all can't handle the truth in a courtroom of lies. Purges the jurors, witnesses, spies. Crooked lawyers, false indictments publicized. It's entertainment, the arraignments, the subpoenas. High-profile gladiators in bloodthirsty arenas. Enter the dragon, black robe, crooked balance. Souls bought and sold and paroled for 30 talents. Court reporter, catch the circus on the paper. File it in the system, not acknowledged by the maker. Swearing by the Bible, blatantly blasphemous. Publicly perpetrating that in God we trust. Cross-examined by a master manipulator. The faster, intimidator, receiving the judge's favor.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch on AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice, with Christopher Liebig. He's an author and he's a criminal defense attorney. And the current book is called Almost Mortal, right?
Yes.
Almost, yeah. I goofed. I forgot to bring the book in. I left it on my kitchen counter. I usually leave it right there so I can look at it and stare at the title so I don't make a fool of myself on the air. So thank you for, if I was wrong, thank you for not embarrassing me. And we also have Sean. Before I do that, going to that music on the break, do you think that, could you hear it down the phone line?
Yes.
Do you think that was an accurate description?
I don't know.
Okay, that's an honest answer.
What do you mean exactly?
Well, in other words, what the singer was singing about, so some of her complaints. I'll play it again. Just
might not. Yes.
That's okay. Here we go.
Cross-examined by a master manipulator, the faster intimidator, receiving the judge's favor.
Do you think that's an accurate charge?
Yes.
That's.
I think that you bring. I mean, it could mean a lot of different things, but what I think is it's. I've heard it as a critique of somewhat of the goofy stage play that a trial or a hearing is in the justice system. People, you know, there are rules that confine what you can say. There are people that are better than others about how to bend the rules. And if somebody's a regular citizen coming in, they just want to tell the truth. But a lot of things aren't admissible, and, you know, it's just, that's how people feel about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, back to speaking.
A lot of people just don't trust it. So go ahead.
Got it. Back to Sean. Sean, did you have a follow up from your previous?
Counselor, you almost said it out loud. I think you got dived off for a spot for just a second. It seems like the whole system to me is just a jobs program, just a way to keep people employed. I mean, what are you going to do if you take all these non-violent offenders of malum prohibitum laws that don't offend anybody but this state that we can't hang from a flagpole? What do you do with all those people, the prison guards, the district attorneys, the judges, and the cops? What do you do with them? If we take this back, what do we do?
Well, it's an extraordinarily powerful lobby on lots of levels. And, you know, federal law enforcement began because of prohibition. when they ended Prohibition, they needed something to do because that's a powerful lobby. And then came the 1937 Drug Control Act, which was the first time the federal government decided to get involved in that. And now we know that's a monstrously huge industry.
Well, if I can interject, the 1934 Gun Control Act, Gun Control, GCA 34, right, Charles?
Yeah, regulated machine guns.
I hadn't thought of that. I suspect that's the same reason. They needed to, yeah. And here's another one with drugs, you know. People with possession of marijuana, they have to go to a treatment program for small possession. That those treatment programs employ, you know, thousands of counselors to give counseling to people that don't need it. And, you know,
I wonder what percentage of drug counselors use themselves.
I don't know the answer to that. I know from, I go to federal court and state court. Federal employee like that probably gets tested, but not at the state level.
You want to bet they don't?
No. They probably do. I mean,
I bet they don't. I remember we had an issue here where the Boston Police Union absolutely demanded that their officers not be randomly tested. And in a response to that, the Pima County Sheriff's Department demanded that they do become randomly tested.
Mm-hmm.
In response to the Boston people. I mean, it was a direct, there was a direct challenge between the Pima County Sheriff's Department Officers Association and the Boston Police Union. The Pima County one said, yeah, test us, go right ahead. And the Boston were going, oh, well, we don't believe in random testing. So, Sean, appreciate your contribution.
Hey, Christopher, thank you very much for telling us about the war against green peppers and tomatoes and things that grow out of the ground. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you, Sean.
And that opens up a line for you in the Perfection Auto Works Studios at 520-790-2040. Did I cut you short on a point?
Nope.
Okay. What is the similarity between telling, and folks, if you just tuned in, let me reset. You're listening to Liberty Watch on AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. The guest is Christopher Liebig. He is an attorney and an author. He's got four novels out now. And Christopher, go ahead and get a little bit further from your microphone. You're getting a lot of artifact noise in there. No problem. The book is almost mortal. It's an interesting book of fiction, but it's based on fact. And then it's, of course, got a fiction twist in it that makes all fiction interesting. The unknown unknown that we can't know. And that's what makes fiction fiction compared to fact. But it's fact-based fiction for the most part. Compared to its, what's the similarity between telling a story in fiction and how a court case works?
I think about that all the time, and here's one of the reasons I love writing fiction, and I'd love to be on a team that wrote a TV show or something, because there are many similarities in that when you have a court case, you're talking about facts and emotions and trying to find the truthful narrative that explains what happened in a way that's believable. Everyone knows that storytelling trials are about storytelling, and the better story wins, and here's the difference, though. When you're brainstorming about a book and it doesn't fit, you can go back and change the facts.
the prosecution changes facts all the time.
Yeah, they do. And it can be done, but for the most part, there are usually big facts that are frozen. And you can't go back and, hey, this would be perfect if we just altered that one a little bit. But the creative process of having a group try to figure out how to talk about a series of events in a way that's consistent with innocence or consistent with a low sentence, that's a very creative endeavor. So a lot of really good defense attorneys, they actually do that all the time. They might not write fiction, but it's very similar.
Got it. All right. Go ahead.
No, I'm good.
All right. And Ira, you're live on Liberty Watch with Christopher Liebig of the book Almost Mortal. Your comment or question for him.
Hi. I'd be curious to know why, I'm sure you pondered this, sir, why are there so many more Democrats that are attorneys in the major offices in the political party and such than there are among Republicans? I'll hang up and listen to your thoughts on that.
It's an interesting question. I might expand it to left-leaning than Democrat, but that's fine.
Okay, well, I I'm running with that. I'm going to try to figure out why that is, and I agree with you that it is. One, there's more, you know, there is probably a tendency for people who are middle, upper middle class or higher, who are have an education level like a lawyer, are in the system, they're satisfied with it, it's good for them, and the idea of having groundbreaking change is not particularly attractive. I think people in that situation may wish to have social programs to help disadvantaged people and such, but what they don't want to do is shake up the system that's working for them. And I mean, a lot of lawyers are wedded to the system. They have to be. It's how they get a job. It's how they get cases. You don't want to offend anybody. And to do it, and to have dramatic change, I mean, you have to be willing to do all those things. I would be curious about a poll, how many law students are in each party. I don't know the answer to it, but I would venture to guess it's about even.
Well, I'll tell you, a Republican or a person who leans to the right is more likely to look at structural change through affecting the legal system. And a person who leans to the left is more likely to go as a crusader into court and try and change things one at a time personally. And a Republican, a person who believes in a representative form of government, in other words, a small R Republican form of government, is likely to want to change things by consensus through a group activity, because there's a group that agrees on a set of principles and wants to govern that way, while the left is more emotional and wants to go in there as a crusader and defend the innocent. That's part of it. It's another thing is, this is analogous to people who go into artwork. People who have a very feeling nature and very sensitive to things and can express that artistically, either through song or print or artistically, you know, artwork, are much more likely mm-hmm. to lean to the left, while in many cases people who are more empirical and more rational tend to go more towards engineering and such, because they value emotion less and they lean more on their reason, and that's part of it too.
I definitely agree. Mm-hmm. We definitely talk about that kind of thing all the time, because one of the big things we do is practice jury selection, think about how mm-hmm. different people are going to react to different things. And I mean, people are also, I would suggest, differ in that way based on gender to an extent.
Yeah,
to an extent.
You don't
want to stereotype people if you don't know them, but there's something to be, if you're trying to win a case based on emotion, you're looking for a different kind of person than you are if you're trying to win it based on facts.
Oh, absolutely. There is the self-descriptive term estrogen pollution. Absolutely enters into the equation. That's my term. It's a Charlesism. Blame me for that rampant sexism, if you will. And stand by on AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero Tucson, the voice in the Perfection Auto Works studios, with Christopher Liebig, author of Almost Mortal. It's an interesting legal thriller with a sort of a paranormal twist to it.
Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom, promotes liberty, and it's such an important show.
This 4th of July, come see 30 Seconds Over Tokyo on the big screen at the Loft Theater, 3233 East Speedway, featuring Van Johnson and Spencer Tracy as Jimmy Doolittle, and their daring raid in the early part of World War II.
I want you to get 24 B-25s with volunteer crews down to Eglin Field. Tell them it's a secret mission.
Doors open at 11, movie at noon. That's this 4th of July at the Loft Theater on Speedway. Doors open at 11.
I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money.
And welcome back to America. Whoops, I was going to say America Armed and Free. That's next hour to Liberty Watch on AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. In the Perfection Auto Works studios, we have the joy and pleasure of having with us Christopher Liebig. He is an attorney and an author, and the current book is Almost Mortal. It's an interesting book, intertwining reality with fiction in a very interesting way. Do you know any clairvoyant or many clairvoyant lawyers?
No, I can't claim for sure I do, but I will tell you this. When you do this kind of work, and lots of types of work, probably yours too, you deal with a lot of people and you can sort of develop the idea that you can get a read on things. And some people are better at that than others. So I do think there are people, you know, there are people that have relative degrees of what you might call clairvoyance or intuition. The danger in that is you can't trust it. It's untrustworthy enough to not bank on.
Yeah,
but
and
the idea of trying to get a read on a person's situation without, in a intuitive way, is very much involved with what we do. So that's why, you know, the idea of the character in the book, the main character, Sam Young, he actually can read minds and use small mind control, and he knows it, but he doesn't really know why he can do it or how and when he should do it, and that's part of what's in the book.
Reminds me of the character in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the female character who doesn't know why she has the power she does in the beginning, in the first two seasons.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Yeah,
I can't think of her name.
Can't think of it.
Beautiful actress that
it
plays
It also
her.
Reminds me of do you remember the storyline of Firestarter by Stephen King?
Vaguely, I do. I'm not a
girl who could start fires
right
with her brain, and her father had mind control ability, and they didn't know why, and it was partially about that. So the sort of prodding mind control ability for Sam Young, I somewhat got the idea from that character in Firestarter. One of the reasons that I'm hoping the book has a chance to catch on big is I think the religious theme in it has not really been done, and hopefully some people would find it interesting. One thing is, it has no religious agenda. It's not preachy in any way, but it kind of touches on the idea that science over time has conflicted with religion in a lot of ways. For example, many, many people who are devout Christians no longer believe the earth was created in 7 days or that other literal things in the book of Genesis are true, because science on these points, if you believe it, has become rather obvious.
Well, nobody knows.
However, there are other things.
Nobody knows how long a day is for God. You know.
Agreed, and we can. Then there's a lot, and I think the people that hold that belief, I respect them, and they, for all I know, they're right. But I'm just saying that has changed things. The science has changed those views for a lot of people. What it hasn't yet ever done, though, is to question some of the fundamental premises of the big world religions, or Christianity in particular, for example, that there's one God, that there's a God that has a consciousness and that there's one, or that there was a virgin birth of Jesus who then resurrected from the dead. These things can't be disproven. It's impossible to prove or disprove them. It's faith.
Well,
but what if somebody came along and disproved part of that? What would the reaction be to that?
There's a concept in your book,
big public way.
There's a concept in your book that deals with that. A person who is homozygotic, which means they only have one set of chromosomes, the female, not the male, which would point towards a virgin birth. It's an interesting concept in the law, and one that you express in there is, do you want to talk about your concept of suing God?
Sure. Well, so there's the main character in the book is Sam Young. He's a defense attorney, and he gets an old journal that's part of what he suspects may be a serial killer case he's working on, and he reads it, and it's about someone who was born in Argentina in the 40s, believes they have special powers, that person's mother resurrected from the dead, and other things. And you see the story of that person coming from the 40s up through to Washington, D.C. in modern times. Along the way, Sam is thinking that through, and what ends up being shown in the book, I don't want to give it all away, but
no, don't give any away. Just hint it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, but the basic concept in my mind is we do a lot of forensic DNA cases. And when you do that, you see how the government proves people guilty through DNA, which is that everyone has certain genetic markers at certain locations that differ from each other. And you get one from your mother and one from your father. The idea of a genetic profile showing up that appeared to only have the genetic profile of a mother, that potentially could happen one time if in the quadrillions, perhaps, chances. But it could happen because sometimes someone gets the same genetic marker from each parent. But if it happened more than if it started happening more than one time, it starts getting towards the place where physicists are willing to call something impossible. And then, you know, in the book ends, and there's a book two on the way, but the book ends basically with, okay, we now have conclusive proof that somebody other than Jesus can rise from the dead and looks to be somebody that has no human father. What's next?
And
to me, I think if that something like that ever happened, it kind of would be akin to like an alien invasion, you know, because people it would just challenge so many beliefs. It's almost like you have to do something about it, but people are slow to figure out what to do about it, if anything.
Well, and
that's kind of where the book ends.
Well, we already know we can't get rid of aliens. We went down a rabbit hole I wasn't planning on. That's okay. That's live radio. You never know where you're going to be. I want to go pedal backwards for a moment. In terms of reading people, have you ever looked in any of the work of Dr. Paul Ekman about deception detection? Okay, then we won't go there.
Not that I know of.
I got it.
We can talk about deception detection if you want.
No, it's okay. We're down to the end of the interview, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole with so little time left. I want to be conscious of the clock, and also I want to be conscious. Do you have a website? Do you have how do you want people to get Almost Mortal? How does that work?
Absolutely. My website is www.chrisleibig.com, and that's Leibig. If you Google Almost Mortal on Amazon, it's there. It's sold at Barnes & Noble. Right now, it's in Barnes & Noble stores in the East, but not in the West. And one thing we're trying to do is to get it everywhere. And so, you know, anybody that felt like checking it out, there's lots of reviews. It won a national award in Chicago, the Next Generation Indie Book Award for 2016. And hopefully the momentum's building, but I'd be really grateful if anybody checked it out.
Okay, two really quick questions. What made you use Flight 1420 as the plot device for your main character's mother's death? Anything special?
No. Tell me what you see there.
Well, interesting. The real 1420 did crash, but only 8 people died in it. The rest survived. There was a real Flight 1420 American, which did crash in the 90s. So it's an interesting thing that you picked that number. Did you just pick that number out of thin air, or did you know about that crash?
You know what? Now that you mention that, you know what? And I'm going to make a confession here that, you know, when you have a publisher, you have editors and people help you. That sounds like too much of a coincidence to be true. I predict that
an editor
did that.
An editor changed it. Okay, I got it. Because when I read a book, I don't just read it.
They probably told me and I forgot.
When I read a book, I don't just read it. I research it. I go into arcane details and I look down not only into the detail, but what's under the detail. And I thought maybe there was something to that, kind of like your SPARF motion. And last question real quick, because we only have 30 seconds. One of your characters is a mean adult victim of bullying, turned prosecutor in adult life. Caricature of one or amalgam of many?
Amalgam of many. It's a well-known kind of prosecutor is someone who is using the power of the office to enact some residual anger they have in general. And they, I believe, see the defendants as an opportunity to do that. But everybody's complicated. And the SPARF character in the book, he's had a hard life, but he turns out to be okay, and he, in some ways, is a great prosecutor. But, yes, there's lots of very awesome prosecutors all over the place, and then there's also ones that I believe use the power improperly, and sometimes it comes from that. So, yes, a Revenge of the Nerds prosecutor, to me, is a real thing.
R-O-N, prosecutor. That's what you've just coined a new phrase. He's an R-O-R-period-O-period-N prosecutor, revenge of nerds prosecution. You know, that could be, you know, like at Chicago Music Store, they have an expression. We have a DC issue on line one. DC is defective customer. They don't realize that the problem is them, you know. And I'm sure you've met a lot of people like that in your life. Okay, one last time on your website, please.
www.cliffleibig.com, and that's L-E-I-B-I-G.
All right.
Cliffleibig.com.
All right, we got to go. Christopher, appreciate you taking the time with us. You have a great day.
Charles, it was fun. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.